Hello and welcome to the Oldie Podcast. I'm Ferdy Rouse, the Oldie's digital editor. Today we have the Oldie's postcards from the Edge columnist Mary Kenny. Mary is one of the founders of the women's liberation movement in Ireland. She's been on Fleet Street for the last 50 years, writing for dozens of newspapers and magazines, including her own columns for the Oldie and the Catholic Herald. And she's also written numerous books. So glad you can be with us, Mary.
Lovely to be here.
So, always good to start at the beginning. What first got you into writing?
Well, you know, Dr. Johnson said that only a fool writes for any other reason but money. And I actually always wanted to be a sort of rather posh writer, you know, writing books and plays and things. But when I was an au pair girl in Paris, right back in the 60s, I was told I could earn 3 guineas. Now, some of our oldie listeners will remember what guineas were, £3 and 3 shillings, by writing an article for the Dublin Evening Press. And I thought, £3 and 3 shillings, my goodness, that will keep me in Paris for a month. So I was very motivated to submit articles to Irish newspapers, and it sort of got me going.
Oh, brilliant. OK. But I have to say, I can't help distracting away from the writing for just a moment. Because I read that you were, in a bit of research for this, that you were expelled from school at 16. Can I ask why?
I was a very naughty girl, actually. Very, very. The Irish have a word for naughtiness. They say bold. You are a bold girl. And, of course, I suppose that's not entirely pejorative in a way, because it sort of carries a bit of an overtone of, you know, being forthright as well. No, I was very, very difficult, and I was disrupting everybody. And the Reverend Mother said that I was very corrupt and I would corrupt everything that I touched in life. So I was terribly pleased with myself about that, actually, because I thought that shows, you know, shows real leadership, that I'm going to corrupt everyone. And, you know, I was one of these odd teenagers who was always reading Oscar Wilde, and it was odd at the time, and the decadent writers of the 1890s, and they were, you know, all in favour of people corrupting each other.
So this career of corruption, did it go on after 16? What did you do afterwards?
Well, I had a lot of different jobs. I was a waitress for a while, and then I worked in offices. I was a typist, and then I spent time in France. And then I did actually get to sort of worm my way into Fleet Street. And in those days, in the middle 1960s, it wasn't as difficult, I think, in a way. At least you could get into journalism, but without being particularly well educated. You know, you could kind of blag your way in. And I did have quite a lot of cuttings, and I was taken up by a very interesting editor called Charles Wintour, who was the editor of the Evening Standard, the father, actually, of the now more famous Anna Wintour of Vogue in America. And he was very good at sort of taking unexpected people on and giving them a chance. So that's, you know, that's the way it went.
I'm intrigued by the point you make about the difference in sort of, like, now it's sort of kind of de rigueur of having the journalism course and, you know, degrees and all that. Do you think that your not having had that gave you a different perspective from having been to university? Would it have, has it helped you, do you think?
Well, I remember asking Paul Dacre, who I worked for the Mail for some years, who was, of course, again, a rather legendary editor of the Daily Mail. And I said to him, do you prefer to have a university graduates, or do you prefer to have people who are, you know, like, just anxious, you know, just really ambitious young people? And he said, I can never make up my mind about that, because he said, in some ways, when you have very ambitious young people, they're a little bit hungrier. They really want to get on. They really need to get on. Whereas sometimes people who've been to university, they're a bit more prudent in a way. And they, you know, they've been taught to do things properly, you could say, which is a very good thing. But he thought sometimes the university, the very over-educated person had lost their edge a little bit. Now, that's just his point of view. Mm. But probably a mixture of both is good. Mm. And also, when I was in Fleet Street back in the 1960s, was it beginning then, I mean, there were a lot more working class people, you know, going into journalism, because they kind of started as copy boys and messenger boys and things like that. Whereas I think it has become much more middle class now.
So do you think with those, the kind of the loss of that other side of journalism, the more, the kind of the industrial aspect of journalism, whereas now the transition to computers has taken away so many jobs, do you think that's that's the principal reason that it's restricted it? Or is it sort of a... I don't know, an educational issue?
Well, it's life has changed a great deal, you know, obviously, as we all know, our people in our vintage. But and there's always good change and bad change, and often it's a mixture of both. But I think far more people are going to university, you know. I think when I was young, I don't know what the numbers were, but certainly in my convent school, for example, I think only about 10 or 12% of the girls I would have known went on to university. You actually had to be very clever, considered to be very clever to go to university. Mm. Whereas now it's kind of routine, you know, everybody's expected to go to college.
Yeah.
So I suppose that's one thing that's changed. And of course, the whole technology of journalism has changed so much, and the internet has changed everything. And there are still very, very good journalists coming on stream, you know, and very, very, doing very good work. But obviously, I think it is a bit more bourgeois.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the 60s. I was wondering, actually, what was it like growing up in Ireland in the 50s and 60s? You mentioned, I think you touched on what it was like for women, particularly the Irish, with the constitution about 37 of, there's that extraordinary line, which is, a good within the home. Well, I don't want to sort of misquote.
Yes, it's a clause in the Irish Constitution, which is very controversial still. And it says, Article 41B, I think, which says that the state recognises the woman in the home and the contribution that she has made, that she makes to the general good by her labour. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but that's it. And it's there is a proposal to remove this because it's considered to be, of course, very patronising, and it's written in the language of the 1930s. This is saying, you know, you good little housewife, you're staying at home. There's a phrase which says she should not be forced by economic need out of the home. And so feminism has understandably sort of interpreted this as, you know, keeping women at home tied to the kitchen sink. But there is another kind of perspective on it now, saying, well, maybe we should just change it to valuing people who are at home, perhaps doing caring work. They do make a contribution to our society. So there's a sort of debate around it. But obviously, all the kind of woke people, if you like, certainly want to get rid of it because they just say, well, it's just so old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, Ireland, growing up in the 50s and 60s, it was very old-fashioned. It was like England in the 20s and 30s, mm-hmm, in many ways. But it was... So it was kind of authoritarian and... We considered it very repressive in some ways. But in other ways, when I was in France, I also realised life in Ireland was actually very easygoing in some ways. Mm. It was very informal and, you know, you could more or less do what you like and walk around the streets of Dublin at midnight if you wanted to, even though you were a 15-year-old girl and nobody ever said a word to you. Mm. You know, so there was that kind of compensation, that it had the benefits of being old-fashioned as well as the disadvantages.
I wonder, actually, when were you in France?
Well, I lived in France from 1962 to 1964.
So, after that sort of those two, 3 years in France, it was Paris, wasn't it?
It was Paris for some time. I also spent some time in the French Pyrenees, teaching French nuns English.
But did that sort of time there give you a fresh perspective on when you came back to Ireland? I mean, how was it with the 2 years away? I mean, what was it like to come back? I mean, you know, you think of the American writers in their 20s and 30s, where they go away and they sort of see America in a different way. I mean, how did it affect you?
I mean, obviously, I wanted to sort of, you know, revolutionise everything because France was beginning to be, you know, of course, they always have this, but there are a lot of demonstrations in the street, the Algerian crisis and so on, and they were always taking to the street and there were always big demonstrations everywhere, and I thought that was terribly exciting. There were a lot of demonstrations against de Gaulle, who was considered to be, you know, a stuffy old thing, very authoritarian. But of course, I think now we look back on de Gaulle and we see that he also was in some ways quite a wise man and certainly brought stability to France, actually, in his time.
Do you think that your experience of France and that sort of, I wouldn't say that's kind of a more rebellious side, that kind of protesting aspect. Was that an inspiration for you for the when you founded the Women's Liberation Movement?
Well, yes, but I think also the 1960s was full of all that anyway, wasn't it? You know, it was the time of demonstrations, mm-hmm. and I went to America quite a bit afterwards too, because my sister lived there. Right. And of course, women's liberation really started, that wave of women's liberation really started in America.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And something I'd never heard of before until about 2 days ago was the contraceptive train. Could you tell me what that was?
Well, I call it the condom train, actually.
Oh, sorry.
Because there was a clause in the Irish Constitution. It wasn't in the Constitution. It was a law which had prohibited birth control artefacts, as they put it, in 1935. But not all contraception was banned because the pill had come on stream by then. So therefore, condoms and other forms of barrier methods of contraception still fell under the prohibition of this 1935 Act. So one of the things we did in the Irish Women's Liberation Movement was to break the law very deliberately by bringing condoms from Northern Ireland and declaring them and so on. And effectively, we did break the law and change the law little by little, as it were. It was just a very, very old-fashioned law. Again, I think in old age, one sees things, of course, with a different perspective. And looking back on the 1930s, quite a lot of countries, actually, several American states and France had laws against birth control in the 1930s because there was a tremendous panic about falling populations and falling fertility.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, just with your latest book, Am I a Feminist? Are You? I wonder whether that would been there at the time and then sort of being able to look back. Is that sort of for lack of a better word, the purpose of it?
Well, it's kind of trying to sum up some of the big questions in feminism, mm-hmm. and some of the perspectives that have changed and the challenges to young women, which are different, very much so, from the challenges that were, you know, when I was a young woman. So it's kind of a review, really, of how things were. I mean, those of us who are older certainly with my peer group in their 70s, women in their 70s, we're very puzzled, actually, quite a lot of the time by all this Me Too stuff. Because, first of all, we liked flirting with men, you know. And secondly, most men were not rapists and assaulters. Most men were terribly nice and they were absolutely sweet to us, you know. And so that's just the perspective of an older woman. Now, either younger women are more sensitive to, the interchange between men and women, or else the culture has changed, and perhaps there are more men who are more boorish. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the sort of the question to sort of ask, mm-hmm. as it were, and debate around, you know.
I'm sure. I couldn't help but notice as well, so I flicked through one of your latest Catholic Herald columns, and you have a very nuanced view on the idea of gender equality and domestic abuse. And I wonder whether the impression I got was that domestic abuse, as you said, was called wife beating for a reason, because it was. And so they can never really be equal. I hate to phrase it like this, but do you slightly object to the sort of the complete equality idea?
Absolutely, yes. I think men and women are different. And I suppose when we started in feminism in the 1960s and 70s, the emphasis was on liberation, mm-hmm. that is emancipation, on freedom to, to make one's life and not to have fetters, or as it were, or blocks in the way of one's career or work or life or whatever. The notion that men and women are, I think equality has to be nuanced very much, because men and women are not the same. And the sort of equality idea has taken away the natural law, and it's blinded people to the natural law, even to the point where today people are saying there's no such thing as biological gender, that it's all socially constructed. Well, that's scientific nonsense. Men and women are born with different chromosomes. So I would, and on the point of domestic abuse, I just think that a man hitting a woman and a woman hitting a man are two very different things, sure. Really. And because men are stronger and bigger and fiercer and, you know, in the raw sense, they have more aggression. Mm-hmm. Therefore, where a man can very easily inflict a lot of damage on a woman, whereas women in general are much, it's much more rare. Women work by other ways. They work by, you know, by social control, by manipulation, by nagging, if you like, by verbal ways. The Italians always say women's great the weapon of the women use is poison, because they've got control of the kitchen. You know, that's one of the things. If women are homicidal maniacs, that's what they would tend to turn to, rather than machetes or you know, blunt instruments and all the rest. And so, therefore, I just think that if we're looking, the law shouldn't assume that men and women are interchangeable and they're the same, you know. I mean, it's quite interesting to look back on prohibition 100 years ago now in the United States. And the feminists at the time campaigned for prohibition because there was so much wife beating, as they called it. And they were very, those American feminists were very aggressive. They took, you know, they closed down the saloon bars and everything like that. But actually, although prohibition turned out to be disastrous in the long run, in the short run, there was a huge drop in violence against women, a huge drop. So there you have an example to where the alcohol has, obviously, the abuse of alcohol plays a part.
So it's why you still have prohibition in some counties in America, actually. It isn't actually over in many ways.
Yes, there's always that little bit of dry counties, aren't there? Still, it's Utah, somewhere like that,
yeah,
is still
a few
bit
spots all over,
that way.
Some regions, I'm not going to say.
Yeah, no, but they still have that tiny little bit. And also, I think you have to be 21 usually to drink in America, rather than 18 or 13 in some cases this side of the Atlantic.
You mentioned sort of the nuance of gender equality and things like that. Where do you stand on the Gender Recognition Act? What do you make of the trans issue?
Well, I don't think that people should be allowed to say that they're men if they're women, or if they're women if they're men. I mean, on the other hand, if somebody wants to imagine themselves to be of the opposite sex, you know, respect to all human individuals. And I think there's a different issue, which is cross-dressing, transvestitism. That's always been in the culture. I mean, it goes back to right through the Commedia dell'arte, you know, of the Middle Ages, and right back to the Greeks. You always had people who wanted to cross-dress. There's no problem with that. You know, I think that's fine. But when you have men who have men's bodies saying they identify as women and going into women's loos because they say they identify as women, it's just surreal, really, you know. But it's a very controversial issue, and people who have stood out against the sort of trans faddishness, I would call it, people like Graham Linehan, for example, you know, the Irishman who wrote Father Ted. I mean, he's had an absolutely terrible time on Twitter and on social media. He's been called a bigot and all kinds of dreadful names because he maintains that men are men and women are women, which even 20 years ago was not really a controversial thing to say.
That's just a segue away. I noticed a lot, in your columns, you mention quite frequently the growing secularisation of Ireland. How's it going down? Is it broadly supported? I mean, from what you say, in from the 50s and 60s, a very conservative culture, and it seems like it's made extraordinarily quick progress incredibly quickly in the last sort of 10 years or so in particular.
I suppose I notice it more because I'm working on a book about Irish social history at the moment. You know, the Irish state will be 100 in 2022, because the Irish Free State was established in 1922. It's a good time to look back. Yes, it was deeply, deeply Catholic country, and now it is, quite the opposite, really. Sometimes when people want to sort of change their mind about something, there's a sort of swing of the pendulum and people go to the other extreme completely, you know. And there is a very conscious effort to secularise Ireland, which is, I don't object to it in the sense that, you know, if that is the democratic will, I think you've got to accept the law and you've got to accept that the culture is changing, you know, and younger people have different attitudes and so on. That's absolutely fair. And also it's a much more multicultural society. I mean, there's actually a higher percentage of people in Ireland who are born outside of the state than there is in Britain, interestingly. 16% of the Irish population today are born outside of Ireland. So there's quite a big influx of immigrants, really. And probably after Brexit now, there will be more people going to Ireland, I should think. So I suppose the laws and the state, they have to reflect that. But there are some interesting little... It interests me to notice the little... There's a sort of quirky side of a traditional Irish life that still sort of hangs on, in a way. And one of the things that some is people going to Ireland are sometimes surprised at, that the national broadcaster broadcasts the Angelus, which is the prayer which Catholics say at midday and at 6 o'clock in the evening. And there are 9 rings to it and then 9 more rings. And there's the whole prayer to the Blessed Virgin, you know. There have been campaigns to take that off the broadcaster or off the airwaves, because like humanists and atheists say, look, the state should be neutral on these things, so we shouldn't have the state broadcast. But actually, every time they do any research about it, they find it's very popular and people actually like it, and they think, you know, it's a little pause for prayer. And the interesting thing, really interesting thing, is that immigrants in Ireland, like Sikhs, for example, are now saying they want to be part of the Angelus as well. So it's a slightly funny Irish situation where you've got the state saying we've got to move towards a secular republic, but still there are these quirky little cultural aspects that are quite embedded in the culture and continues.
But even though some, I say, more conservative, I mean, I hear that's essentially code for Catholic, I suppose. I noticed that you mentioned a couple of sort of substitute traditions which have sort of come in, I think, sort of which are sort of more directly Celtic roots.
Yes, I mean, people are inventing new ceremonies for marriages, for example, or naming ceremonies, which are sort of, if you like, going back to a kind of nature-based or pagan source. I think that's fine. In fact, I think it's much better to have a pagan naming ceremony than when a baby comes into the world and there's no ceremony. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find a little bit more regrettable, really, because when a baby comes into the family or into the world, it's really nice to have a kind of welcoming ceremony of some kind, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And most anthropological studies do show that there are naming ceremonies or welcoming ceremonies. The Irish funeral is changing, for example, but the Catholic funeral has still hung on quite well, because I think a church funeral does have a kind of, when it's well done, it does have a kind of dignity, you know, and it does have a kind of catharsis even, if it's done right. So that has hung on again.
I see. Very, very briefly, about 2 minutes ago, mentioned the B word, Brexit. I was wondering, with Ireland's recent election has been described as being, you know, Ireland's Brexit moment. Would you say that's about true?
Well, it was very surprising to most commentators that Sinn Féin did so well. And it seemed to have come out of nowhere. You're watching, if you like, a step change. At the same time, with Irish politics, sometimes there's an element of plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, because it's a very complicated system of proportional representation, and it takes absolutely ages to form a government, and they have to do lots and lots of horse trading, so that, in fact, the government becomes a collection of politicians who may have absolutely nothing in common with each other at all. So that's still very much in the mix. But there is a new generation who, I suppose, want different things from politics. And there's a lot of anger, even though there's a lot of prosperity in Ireland, full employment and so on. But there's a lot of anger about issues like health. You know, the health service is in big trouble. People are sort of lying on trolleys for 3 or 4 days. Well, the health service is in trouble, I think, in the UK as well. It's quite difficult to maintain the sort of standards that the public want. And also housing is very difficult. So you've got young couples who are maybe earning, you know, 70 or 80,000 euro a year, and they still can't afford a home. So that is a kind of a big bread and butter issue. But Brexit has been very headlined in Ireland because they are aware that it's going to hit them, and also it will hit the border with Northern Ireland. Such interesting things are happening. I think, I can't remember the numbers now, but tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people from Britain and elsewhere are now taking up Irish citizenship, because you only need one Irish grandparent to claim an Irish passport. And I was told recently that actually about 20 of the top British civil servants who are involved with Brexit are themselves taking out Irish citizenship, which is kind of a really comical situation in a way.
I was intrigued you mentioned the border, something which was been quite noticeable. I think, if I have my facts right, in Northern Ireland there is the unionist vote it's no longer got a majority. And so there's been speculation that there's quite strong demonstrations of support for Irish unification on both sides of the border. Do you think it's not beyond the realms of possibility?
It will happen sometime, but not in my lifetime, and maybe not even in your life. I don't know, I can't say. I mean, I think the Irish attitude to unity has always been very Augustan. Oh, Lord, make us united, but not yet. Because it is something to take on a whole province which has different cultures in many ways. It is a challenge. And I mean, obviously, it would kind of make economic sense. That's why, you know, people like the Financial Times and the Economist are often interested in United Ireland. But whether it is doable in community sense, I think you really have to proceed slowly. And I would like to know, what flag are you going to have? What anthem are you going to sing? What measurements are you going to use on the roads? You know, the Northern Ireland has miles, the Republic of Ireland has kilometres. Small, are you going to have Irish language signs all over Northern Ireland? They can't even get an Irish language act through Stormont. So there are a lot of these symbolic and cultural issues really to be ironed out. And I think, you know, you have to approach it with prudence, but with optimism.
I hope you don't mind asking me this question. I wanted to sort of ask a bit about your husband, if that's all right with you.
Sure. Sure.
Well, I suppose first, I mean, how did you meet? How did you come across him?
Oh, well, we were in Fleet Street, you know, and I think we met in a pub. But I think we also met with friends in the country as well.
And sorry, just so that readers and our delightful listeners know, this is Richard West.
Richard West, yeah.
You know, stellar foreign correspondent. Well, he was something of a Fleet Street legend, wasn't he?
Dick was a very bohemian kind of person who was very, but very well educated, and had a terrific interest in all kinds of foreign places. I mean, he wrote several books about Africa, books about Vietnam, and he was a specialist in the Balkans, and as you know, was spoke Serbo-Croat and wrote, did a biography of Tito and so on. So
we got that fantastic. He was dubbed, was it Agent Friday?
I didn't even know that.
I heard he was dubbed Agent Friday by the Polish police. This is
oh, really?
I mean, possibly, you know.
I wouldn't be at all surprised. But again, that is a world that has sort of gone where you had rather unusual people, sort of, who were freelance journalists and who had a very, sometimes an eccentric view of the, of the world, and very often a very penetrating one. But we didn't agree about the Balkans. It wasn't for me to disagree with him in a way, but certainly he was rather a defender of Yugoslavia. He felt that was the right way to bring that country together, whereas I knew Croatian friends who very much didn't want to be part of Yugoslavia. So this was all very lively.
Your son gets a mention in Alden's notes. In his new book, Small Men on the Wrong Side of History, he says of your husband that he comes across as slightly sort of obstinate, perhaps. He would deliberately smoke on National Non-Smoking Day. I wonder, did this bloody-mindedness ever... how was it?
The French have a very nice way of describing that. They call it esprit de contradiction. which is, I think, something I'm, a bit quite familiar with myself. Yes, so I suppose Dick could have a sort of counter reaction to being told what to do and what is the right thing to do, and to not be very biddable in that way. But that's fine. I think that's rather refreshing, because too much conformity in any society isn't a good thing.
You've written very candidly about what it was like to look after him. Could you explain what happened and what it was like?
Well, he did have a stroke in the 1990s, and he did well for a while. But gradually, I think he had, people with strokes often get a lot of other mini strokes, so gradually he did become more and more disabled, and eventually he became bedridden, really. And so the last 10 or 12 years of his life was pretty tough on him, actually, because he'd been very active, independent.
Of course, travelling all over the world.
Yes, travelling, and very, very much, singular, somebody who depended on no one, really. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really hard for... when a person gets old and disabled, who has that frame of mind that they're independent-minded, and suddenly they're very dependent. Mm. Well, not even suddenly, I should say, gradually more, but they're very dependent. And there is a phase, I think, of anger and resentment and frustration. But I think he also showed a lot of character, really, and became very, very... became kind of accepting towards in the last few years of his life, and very, very sweet-natured and so on. And I suppose, this is something that we all think about in old age, how we will cope with the last few years of our lives and facing those things. I also came to see the sense, which is much disparaged today, the stiff upper lip, which is, considered to be, I think Meghan Markle said was the thing that she disliked about the English very much. But actually, that notion of being stoical and of, not complaining too much in the face of suffering is actually very admirable, I think. And it does serve people. They find inner resources if they have that kind of stoicism. Mm. And I did come to admire that.
Mm. Did you sort of draw on it yourself? How was it for you? I mean,
Well, it wasn't easy, actually. It isn't easy. But I got help, and we got through. And I was fortunate in the sense that I was able to go on working. You know, be one of the great things about modern media is that you can work on a computer at home, you know, and you can work by mm-hmm. the internet and email, and that was a great advantage.
Mm-hmm. I think just to, as a sort of concluding question, bit of a cliche, why do you write? What is it that most sort of inspires you to pick up the pen?
Well, it's interesting because I did say that when I was young, I wanted to earn some money, and I thought that was a good way.
Has that held true till now, do you think?
Well, I suppose it is still important, I think, to be, you know, the Bible says the labourer is worthy of his hire, if I remember from my convent school. So I think that's fair enough. But I suppose it's also a compulsion. I mean, it's something I do every day as a compulsion. I have to do it, in a sense. I'm a great admirer of Anthony Trollope, whose life was fascinating because he was a poor little overlooked post office clerk who had no proper life in London. And then he went to Ireland. He was sent to Ireland in the 1840s. And he completely reinvented himself. He began to be a writer. He began to go hunting, and he found his true vocation and nature and so on. And that's a lovely story. But one of the things that he wrote in his autobiography, there should be no day without writing something. Every single day you should write something. And he used to get up at 4 in the morning and write in his carriage as he was going to, because he worked for the post office in Ireland, for the Royal Mail. And I think that's great. You know, I identify with that no matter what, you should write something every day.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to end the podcast. Mary, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a delight.